year in radio broadcasting with views not heard in the news, the International Taz and Paula Show interviews experts from all walks of life, bridging research and personalized journeys, revealing new ways to unleash life with a passion of a heartbeat. And now, here's Taz and Paula.
Well, here's to a fabulous day wherever you are. And if you weren't on the edge of getting excited about life, you will be by the end of this interview. Right now, I feel wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, as the saying goes, because our next guest has captivated life in ways not many have experienced and put into print that this historical input can allow for new beginnings to arise and our world can be seeded with true earth history. Today, we are speaking with Thomas J. Carey, whose latest book, co-authored with Don Schmidt, The Children of Roswell, A Seven-Decade Legacy of Fear, Intimidation, and Cover-Ups. This book simply speaks to lifting humanity so that trust can return. Paula, this is so very exciting and powerful. You are now listening to the International Taz and Paula Show. I'm Taz.
And I'm Paula. Well, Thomas J. Carey, an Air Force veteran who held top secret clearance and has been on the leading edge with investigations what really happened to Roswell in 1947. Tom has published over 40 works on this particular subject, and he has lectured on the radio and TV, appeared as a guest on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie, and then again with Larry King Live, the Fox News Channel, and Sci-Fi Channel documentary, the History Channel, the Roswell documentaries, to name a few. Thomas Carey, we are so proud and honored to have you with us today. Welcome to our show. You with us?
I am here.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, my first question is, yes, we can now.
Paula and Taz, I am honored to be with you today.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
My first question for you, Tom, is how did you meet Donald Schmidt, your co-author? How did you, the two of you get together?
Well, that's a good, that is a good question. Let's see. This would be 1991. That's 25 years ago. My goodness. I had read the book The Roswell Incident, which was published in 1980, and the book just really blew me away. I had been interested in UFOs most of my life, but as you know, as a casual reader, that was pretty much it. But I was very interested in the subject, and I became the Mutual UFO Network's state section director for southeastern Pennsylvania from 1986 to about 2001. And I also had joined an outfit in Chicago called the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, mostly to get their monthly publication, which was called the International UFO Reporter. Well, in that journal that they published every month, there were stories about these two fellas who were opening up the Roswell investigation again, because not much had been written after the 1980 book. So these two fellas, one was named Kevin Randall and the other was named Don Schmidt. They were a team. They were reopening the Roswell case, and I said, this sounds interesting. And so I read a few of their articles, and enough to know that they were really on the ball and serious about it. So I called up Kevin Randall and asked them about who was doing anything about investigating the alleged archaeologists. There was a team of archaeologists who allegedly were the first ones at the crash site back in 1947. And had either Kevin or Don done anything about trying to find out who they were? And Kevin said, well, basically, no. So I said, listen, I have a background in anthropology and archaeology. I live right outside of Philadelphia where the University of Pennsylvania is, which is where these archaeologists were allegedly from. It was the University of Pennsylvania, Ivy League school. I said, let me go down to the university, poke around and see what I can find out about these archaeologists. Well, most of the time in that period, I talked to Kevin Randall, rarely to Don Schmidt, and it wasn't until 1998, now this is like a number of years later, that I found myself on the board of directors of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies in Chicago, and I went to the meetings in Chicago, and at one of these meetings, Don came down from Wisconsin. He lives up there in right outside of Milwaukee, and he came down to the meeting, and I met him, and he said, you know, he's going to be traveling to Roswell the next month. Would anybody like to come with him? And I said, yeah, I'll go. I'd like to go down to Roswell. I've never been there. I've been interested in this case, and let's see what we can find out. And so that was our really our initial research collaboration, May of 1998. And we've been a team since then, which is now, 1998 to now is, what is that, 18 years?
Yeah.
Which is a long, long time in any endeavor. So that's how we became a team, because no one else was doing it that you know, in 1997. I don't know if you recall it or not, but that was the 1997 was the 50th anniversary year of the Roswell crash, and there's a lot of hoopla surrounding it that year. It was featured on the cover of Time magazine. CNN spent a whole day down in Roswell on July the 4th, and most of the Roswell books were written that year. And once that was all over, people, you know, they basically lost interest in Roswell, and Don and I wanted to continue investigating the case in a proactive way. I mean, by proactive, I mean actually going out in the field, doing what they used to call gumshoe work, investigating, knocking on doors, interviewing witnesses, traveling to the crash site, seeing, having an archaeological dig. That's the proactiveness of it, as opposed to just sitting back in your easy chair and waiting for a phone call that will never come.
Now, were people actually available that you could talk with it when you knocked on their door, that they were willing to say something?
Most of them were not happy to see us. They were not happy. In fact, we had a number of doors slammed in our face, and when we call them on the phone, they hang up. And you have to be able to handle rejection. And,
Were they intimidated? And they were, you know, by maybe government officials?
Yes, the ones that would not talk to us, they were intimidated back in 1947. And as we found out from the children, our most recent book that came out this year is called The Children of Roswell, A Seven-Decade Legacy of Fear, Intimidation, and Cover-Up. And it features the children rather than the actual participants in the event, who are mostly 99% gone now. Figure this. A 20-year-old back in 1947, next year will be 70. Will be 90 years old. We're approaching 70 years from the event. So we've been increasingly talking to first children. Well, first it was the original participants, and then it was the children, and now the grandchildren we're talking to. So, yes, they were intimidated. Whole families were intimidated. They were threatened with death if they ever talked about what they knew. And I have to say that the cover-up did last for 31 years, from 1947 to 1978 when the first person of note, the base intelligence officer back at Roswell in 1947, broke silence. He was on a ham radio network, and he started talking about the case, and that was 1978. And back in those days, Stan Friedman was going around talking about his about UFOs and the cover-up, and he was found himself in Louisiana. I don't know if it was Baton Rouge or New Orleans, but he'd given a talk down there. And after the talk, someone suggested that he talk to this fellow who lived not too far away in Louisiana named Jesse Marcel, who had been the base intelligence officer at the Roswell base in 47, that Stan should talk to him because he claimed to had handled pieces of an actual flying saucer some years ago. So before he left Louisiana, Stan called Jesse, and thus began the civilian investigation of the Roswell incident. That was in 1978. 2 years later, they wrote their book, The Roswell Incident, which is the book I mentioned earlier that I read that really turned me on to the case. And when I hooked up with Don in 1998, I wanted to do something proactive. I want to actually be involved in a nuts and bolts case of UFOs, rather than, you know, when I was the MUFON state section director, you know, the reports I was getting were mostly lights in the sky and that sort of thing, and I don't know if you've ever investigated anything like that, but after the fourth or fifth one of those, it gets pretty old and monotonous. So I wanted to do something else, and along came this the Randall and Schmidt team, who were reopening the Roswell case, and ultimately I hooked up with Don in the mid-1990s. The late 1990s, and we're still at it. In fact, we found three new witnesses this year. You never know. Just when you think there's no more, you find some. But
were they young witnesses or older witnesses?
Oh, these were fellas in their 80s. They were there at the base in 47. And
by the time you're 80, you don't care what you say.
right. But what we found, mostly the people who wouldn't talk to us were ones who had been threatened and warned not to talk about it. And the other ones who they may or may not have been threatened, but what they were either military or government retirees, and they were on government pensions. And their fear was that if they talked about Roswell, that they would lose their government pensions. So that's a big gun at your head, to speak. No matter what we would tell them, that, you know, you have nothing to fear, that no one has ever been had any result like that, where they lost a pension or something, you know, something nefarious. They were not going to upset their pensions. They were not going to take the chance. But fortunately, there were enough people who weren't on government pensions and did not make the military a career, and those are the ones that talked the most. They were not on a government pension. They were civilians, and they didn't make the military career, so they didn't have those guns hanging over their, or that noose hanging over their head. So those are the ones that talk mostly.
One of the stories I've heard, which may not be true at all, but that their memories had been messed with at one point. Did you ever hear that story?
No. Say that. I'm sorry.
The witnesses' memories were messed with by the government. So I don't know if you... that was just a story I heard.
I have not heard that story. I know, the sheriff of Chavez County, George Wilcox, He died young, and his wife, Inez, now he was the sheriff when this all this was going on, and his wife said to the day she died, no, that doesn't sound right. She said to the day she dies, we got this story from her daughters, and her daughters told us that their mother believed to the day she died that her husband, the sheriff, had been given something by the Air Force that made Alzheimer's onset very early, and he died of Alzheimer's, but he had a very early onset, and his wife felt that he had been messed with by the Air Force.
Yeah.
So, but if you have a story, that's pretty near the only one that I've heard of.
The artifacts they found, the pieces, a lot of local people had pieces of the artifact. Has any of them been? Any of the artifacts been found?
That's our biggest disappointment in the case. Our investigation is that we've had a number of stories from people who claim to have artifacts or know of people who have artifacts, and whenever we investigate them, we always reach a point where we say they run away on us. They stop communicating, which leads us to conclude that they never had anything. They were either playing tricks or who knows what they were doing. We've had a lot of that. But we know that there are artifacts out there, especially with the ranchers that lived around Roswell, because they got to the crash site first. And we've heard stories that so-and-so has a piece or several pieces, and when we confront that person, they say, oh, no, I don't. Where did you hear that story? So, but we believe that people in certain cases who have told us about that we believe that's true, but for some reason they're not producing them. But we've had several archaeological digs out at the site, and unfortunately we haven't come up with anything there. But we do believe that if we are going to find the piece, it's not going to be at the actual site, because they had soldiers down on their hands and knees cleaning that up. And they brought in machinery to scour the desert floor, so there was nothing left. But we suspect that the winds out there had blown some of the pieces maybe miles away from the site. So someday some hiker is going to inadvertently trip over a piece somewhere out there, we hope. And
I kind of question if you were out there investigating in that format. Was there, by chance, a different kind of frequency on the ground that was left from this crash, and that could be assumed that maybe it was because of that?
Oh, a different frequency, you mean like some sort of radioactivity or something?
Radioactivity or who knows what the equipment, or the, finds might have left behind, even minuscule pieces that, might.
We have a fellow on his own. He's been out to the site many times. He lives in Roswell, and he's a geologist, and he frequents the site, and he's found a lot of little pieces of, they look silvery, and so far none of them has turned out to be otherworldly. So the thing is that they took a week to clean up that site, and they had hundreds of soldiers out there, or airmen, and they even had them down on their knees with orders to pick up anything that wasn't natural. So the actual site itself, which is about a mile long and a couple hundred feet wide, that was scoured. In fact, they would go back years later just to make sure there wasn't anything that popped up, you know, that might have been hidden behind a bush or something that had blown out or had come up from a rain shower. So they've covered the waterfront, as you would say, in trying to locate little shards of wreckage.
When you wrote this book, this latest book, The Children of Roswell, when you wrote it, was there, like when you're writing a book, sometimes something just kind of goes, surprises you that you even remembered to put it in, or an unusual experience took place as you were writing it? And it left you wondering if your readers would be able to capture the essence, the sheer essence and the impact that it had on you.
In one chapter I wrote, my co-author said I was going to have to tone it down because we might get sued, because it was a chapter on Richard's. Do you have a copy of the book?
I did. I see Richard's Cave, yes.
Yes, it's Richard's Cave. And that was quite an experience, and I had to really tone that down because Richard's Cave is actually we had looked for it for years. We had heard these stories about this fellow named Dan Richards, who was a teenager at the time of the crash. And he was sort of a ne'er-do-well fella. He was always challenging authority and what have you. And up around Corona, where he lived, see, the ship exploded in the air over near Corona and rained down all this little pieces of debris. Well, Dan was one of the first ones to the site, and he pocketed a number of pieces of this wreckage. And we talked to friends of Dan's, because Dan, he died in 1950. He had just gotten his driver's license, and he celebrated by killing himself. He drove a pickup into a telephone pole, so it was a solo accident, and that was it for him. And but his friend said, "Oh, have you found his cave?" We said, "No, where is it?" And they said, "Well, it's up near Corona, up near their ranch. They had an old ranch there." Well, that area is really rife with caves because it's a limestone area, and when you mix limestone and water, you get a cave. So there are a lot of them up there. So we searched for years to find out where this cave was. We finally found somebody who told us that, "Oh, yeah, he knows where it's at." And he gave us directions because he was real old. He couldn't take us to it, but he gave us directions. And he said, Dan had these funny pieces of wreckage that he got from a flying saucer crash. And he said, "I used to throw them pieces up in the air, and he would shoot them with a rifle that he had stolen from the military. This was an army rifle, and he would shoot these little pieces just to see the bullets bounce off, you know?" And he says, "Boy, that was really something. And, you know, he had a lot of stuff in that cave, usually stuff that he didn't want people to find." So in the meantime, we had located the woman who turned out to be Dan Richards' cousin. She was now running the ranch. And so we contacted her, and she said, "Oh, yeah, come on out. I know where that's I think I know where that cave is." So we went out to the ranch. And let me tell you, this is Don Schmidt and I, neither one of us have ever smoked, you know. We never smoke cigarettes. We don't drink. Well, we knock on the door, come on in. So, and the minute I entered the house, now, the only thing I can liken it to is if you're like, you have an allergy to like animal fur, and you start gagging. Well, the minute I stepped in the house, I started gagging because it was rife with cigarette smoke, stale cigarette smoke. I said, oh, my God, what am I going to do here? And so we entered the house, and over to my left there was an elderly man in his, I would say, 70s or 80s, and he's sitting there in the corner in a lounger, and he's smoking a cigarette, and his ashtray is filled up about a foot high with ashes. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, what do we got here? And so we're walking towards the kitchen, and I noticed that the dog was wearing a smoking jacket. And I looked over, you know, in the floorboards, the floor molding, I saw a little critter, you know, like it lives in the, you know, bugs, and they were wearing smoking jackets. And so everybody in that house was smoking like a chimney. And Don and I are gagging. And so we sit down at the kitchen table because we want to find out what this woman knows about the Richards Cave. And we no sooner sit down than in comes this fellow. Now, do you remember the movie Magnificent Seven?
Yes.
Well, that was a movie where the townsfolk were being overrun by these banditos, and they hired this group of seven gunslingers to clean out the banditos. Well, in comes this fellow. He looks like one of the banditos from the Magnificent Seven. I have a picture of him in our book. His name is Trinidad Trini Chavez, and it looks like he's been chomping on his hat. But I have a nice picture of him in the book, and I had lost that picture for a number of years. I was really kicking myself because I thought it was a classic photo. He's just a classic bandito, and he sits down. And he looked across from me, and he says, are you a lawyer? I said, no. He says, are you sure? I said, yeah, I'm not a lawyer, because if you are, I'm coming over there. I'm going to kill you. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, we got to get out of here. And Don Schmidt always, he likes wearing black. He likes wearing black. So he's dressed all in black with black sunglasses. He looks like a classic revenueer. So he looks over at the guy, he says, well, what about him? Is he a lawyer? And Don goes, no, I'm not a lawyer. Well, if you are, because you're dead too. And so we're thinking, my God, are we going to get out of here alive? So it turns out that Trini Chavez had gotten to the crash site with, after he calmed down, he had told us he had gotten to the crash site with Dan Richards. And they're there on the periphery, just over, you know, they're hunched down looking. He said they could see all these military guys down on their hands and knees picking up stuff from the desert floor and putting them in burlap bags. And Treaty told Dan, he says, blankety blank, I'm not going to be able to get any, some souvenirs because there's too many military guys there. And so Dan told him, he said, Don't worry about it. I got a lot of stuff in my cave. I was here before. I got a lot of stuff in my cave. So Trini says, oh, okay, well, so they stay a while, then they left. Well, turns out Trini's father had also been to the site and had gotten a piece, but the military confiscated it. So So he asked the missus, who was running the ranch here, well, what about, do you know where Richard's cave is? She says, well, you know, I think the entrance to it is in Dan's old bedroom. I said, oh, my goodness, can you imagine a cave emptying into your bedroom? So we went in, took a look. No, it didn't. I don't know where she got that story. But so
maybe
we're just about to leave. We're just about to leave, and I noticed she's in the kitchen. She's cooking something in a pot, and it looked like the hind quarter of some furry animal with the fur still on it. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, what is that? And she's cooking away. You know, it's in a pot of water and it's cooking, but there's a hoof on it and there's fur. And I'm thinking, well, is that a cow or is that a what is that? And she says, you boys are staying for dinner, aren't you? I said, no, we have another interview back in Roswell. And I said, isn't that right, Don? And Don's sort of licking his chops, you know, like, boy, I can't wait for this. And we got out of there so fast, your head would spin. So that was one of the strangest interviews. We were lucky to, you know, we felt gratified that we got out alive. So
wow.
It's not all fun and games. You take them as they come, and that one really was something. To cut to the chase, we did find Richard's cave. We did find it. It turned out to be a huge sinkhole that had collapsed upon itself, and it was actually fenced off by the Bureau of Land Management. But I sent Don in there. Don, go take a look. But Don stayed on the roof of the cave. He didn't go inside because who knows, it might collapse again, you know?
Yeah.
So he got to the roof of the cave, and I took a picture of him from outside the fence. And we have a picture of that in the book. Don's kneeling over the entrance to the cave, which we didn't go in. But we do understand from another witness who did get into the cave before it collapsed, that all the wreckage that Dan had collected was not there anymore. So it suggests to us that the military, when they came to relieve the piece of wreckage from Trini Chavez's father, they also went to the Richards cave and retrieved everything from there that was from the wreck. So, but it took all that whole scenario took almost a decade to complete. So, you have to be in it for the long haul. We sort of chuckle when we hear people, well, I'm going to Roswell this weekend. I'm going to solve that case. Wow, what have we been doing wrong, you know? So.
Well, what is the difference between, when you were interviewing the adults, besides that they were pretty old by then, and the children that were involved? What was the difference between the interviews between the two?
Well, many of the adults, you know, when we interview them, they're in their, when we started out, they were in their 60s, then they were in their 70s, then they were in their 80s, and now the ones we're interviewing, which ones are left, the youngsters back then are now in their late 80s, and some are in their 90s. So you have to, as we speak, you have to be cognizant of the age of the person. If it's an older person, you have to handle them differently than a child, you know, some of the children and some of the grandchildren. We can speak as we're speaking now, but when you're speaking to somebody in their 90s, they tend to rattle off, you know, they tend to go off track, and you have to keep them focused on why you're there and what subject we're talking about, because a lot of them, when they're that old, they like to tell you about their entire life, and you know that could
right.
take a couple of days. So, different techniques. That's a good question, because there are different techniques involved. Youngsters, you don't have to, you know, they're, you know, like we're talking now. But we had a fellow a few years ago. He was in his early 90s. He was an archaeologist, but I remember when we had to interview him, we would flip a coin, and the loser was the one that had to interview him, because to get 30 seconds of information, you had to spend like a couple hours with him, because he kept going off on these tangents, and it took you a while to figure out, oh, he's not telling me about the case. He's going off on his life story again. And it's just there's certain techniques you have to be aware of with whom you're speaking.
Tom, you have a chapter in your book. Tom, you have a chapter in your book, The Little Houdini, who made a flying saucer disappear.
Yes.
Will you capture some of that essence?
Yes, that was one of Don's chapters. Actually, I had never heard of that until I read the proof, the proof of the book. I said, "Wow, what is this? I don't know that one." Well, Don had interviewed. I know he called me up one day, see, because I have a copy of the old base yearbook from Roswell from 1947. It's a photocopy. It's not like a one you get in the library. You know, they have the phone books from every year. Well, the phone books from in the Roswell City Library for 1948. Now, if you have a 1948 phone book, that means most of the data in there was collected in 1947, right?
Yeah,
and,
right.
And that's the way it works. So the 1948, there were two phone books for that year, one in the Roswell City Library and one in City Hall. Both of them are missing for 1948. I do have a photocopy of the 1947 yearbook. I'm sorry, the telephone book for Roswell. But you have to understand that's data from 1946. So it's not quite there of being 1947. So the two from 48 are gone. So my goodness, I forgot my train. I forgot my train of thought. Where am I going? What was the question again?
We were talking about the little Houdini who made a flying saucer.
Oh yes, see there. There is an example. There is an example of what I run into. Oh my goodness. That was unplanned. That was unplanned. I went off on a tangent. But the little Houdini, that's what it was. Don had called me to check the city directory for 47 to see if a certain name was in it, and it was. So it turned out to be, the Houdini turned out to be the name's father. Well, the father of Houdini in this chapter was a dispatcher for the local, there was a railroad spur that ran through Roswell just outside of the air base where the big hangar was, where all this wreckage was stored. There was a railroad spur. I don't know which railroad it was, but he was a dispatcher, to make sure that they had enough boxcars for whatever was being sent away. So this one day he had a request to be at this railroad spur just outside the base, just outside where the big hangar was at a certain time. So he was there. There was a boxcar that he had ready. And out comes a big truck from this big hangar with all this funny wreckage in it. And it pulls up to the gate. They say, "Open the gate." So he opens the gate, and they unload all this stuff, all these little pieces of wreckage, into the boxcar. Well, he noticed that in doing this, the one of the airmen had dropped a piece of the wreckage, and he didn't see it. And he says, "Oh boy, I wonder if he's going to leave that there, or if he's going to pick it up." Well, they finished their loading, and they went back to they closed the gate, and back they went to the base. And the airman didn't see the little piece. So I forget the gentleman's name. Anyway, he went over. After he shut the door on the boxcar, they signed off on the requisition, et cetera, et cetera. He goes over, and after they had left, he put his foot on top of the piece of wreckage, and he sort of pressed it down into the earth, to cover it up. So, because he didn't want to let anybody know that he was picking up something right there. So he put his foot on it and ground it into the dirt. He was going to come back later and get it. So that evening, it's dark outside. It's real late at night. He gets in his car and he drives to the base, you know, where that was, where they were doing that loading. And he says, "Oh, geez, I wonder if it's there." He goes, it's there. They didn't see it." Well, of course not. It's late at night now. If they didn't see it during the day, what are they going to do at night? So he picks it up, puts it in his pocket, and goes home. I guess he showed it to his wife. We don't know. But he didn't show it to his son, his son. Now, they kept it for his son was real young, right? You know, too young to understand what was what, maybe, you know, 2 or 3 years old. Well, the son is now approaching his 6th birthday, and the father had kept this piece of wreckage. It was a piece of memory metal, the kind you can wad up in your hand, and you open your hand over like a desk or a flat surface, and the thing just unfurls itself and just gently floats down without a crease. You can't scratch it, you can't cut it, without a crease, and it's what we call memory metal. There was a lot of it in the wreckage. Well, for his son's 6th birthday, he gives him a box. And the son says, "Oh, Dad, well, thank you. Well, what is this?" He says, "Well, open the box." So he opens the box, and in there is this piece of metal, memory metal. And the kid said, "Well, what's this?" He says, "Well, pick it up, you'll find out." So he picks it up, and it's light as a feather, it's very thin. He crunches it up, and he does the number on it. It unfurls itself and floats down to the table. Well, the son is 6 years old. He has a little magic show that he does for his six-year-old friends. And I guess what, 6 years old, you're in what, first grade, second grade, something like that. And so they had a little shack out in the backyard that he used to put on these magic shows, such as they were for a six-year-old. And so he started including, for the grand trick in his magic show, he would bring out this box with this little piece of memory metal, and he would put it through its paces, and everybody would just sit there with their mouth open. "Oh, my God, what is that?" Well, after a while, adults started showing up, because the kids would go home and tell their parents about, "Hey, wow, little Johnny, he's got the, you want to see this." And so after a while, adults started showing up to the kids' magic show. And again, for the grand finale, he would do this little trick with the memory metal. Well, one day, it was time to do another show, and lo and behold, the little box with the memory metal was gone. Somebody had stolen it. Now, whether it was one of the parents, one of the kids, or if the parents had told somebody and word got around, nothing else was taken from this little shack where it was the club. Let's call it a clubhouse. A shack sounds pretty bad. Let's call it the kids' little clubhouse. And nothing else was taken, just this little box with the memory metal in. It was never seen again.
That's too bad. Can you tell us
that's where you get the Houdini. That was a little kid doing his magic who made the a spaceship disappear. That's how the Don came up with that title. But it's an interesting story. But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask you to tell us about the former NFL pro football player who was involved.
Yes.
And what was his role?
Yes. What's interesting is in the book, we talk about so many families that were haunted by this event back in 1947. First, the appearance of aliens from outer space crashes on your doorstep. And then you get threatened by your own military, who was sworn to protect you. You're threatened with your life by our own military to remain silent. So a lot of the families that this happened to, they, of course, remained silent until the late 70s when civilians came a-knocking. And they were haunted. There were a couple suicides. We don't know if anybody was outed or not, but some people disappeared. And, as you know, sort of every reaction. Well, there was this one fellow. I did not know he was from Roswell. He was a football player for the Philadelphia Eagles, NFL football team, who, by the way, haven't won a championship since 1960. And he played for the Eagles. In fact, this fellow was on the Eagles' last championship team. His name was Tom Brookshire. And it turns out, it's a long story how I found out he was from Roswell. My wife actually found it when we were down there one year. She discovered his name on an honorary plaque. And I noticed that they were all football players in the NFL. And one of the names on the plaque was Tom Brookshire. I said, oh, my goodness, I didn't know he was from Roswell. So when I got home, I called him up. And Brookshire was he was a defensive back. He was an all-pro, but his career ended abruptly when he broke his tibia, that's the big shin bone, in a game against the Chicago Bears in 1961. And after that, he became a renowned football or sports broadcaster. He broadcasted NFL games, and he started... In Philadelphia, he started the concept of all sports radio, 24/7 all sports, all talk radio. And that was his idea, and he started that. Well, in 1947, he was 16 years old. And he was a football player and a baseball player and a basketball player at Roswell High School. And he was also his father owned a service station on Main Street in Roswell. Now, the air base, the Roswell Army Airfield, was like 5 miles south of town. And a lot of the airmen who owned cars would fill up their cars at his father's gas station on Main Street. And Tom, especially during summer vacation, which is when this happened, he would spend days pumping gas at his father's gas station. He got to know a lot of the fellas at the base, and you know, from pumping their gas and from also playing them in various sporting events. So I called up Tom when I got back home. This was like 2008. I called him up. I said, I understand you're from Roswell. And he said, well, yes. I said, do you remember the 1947 UFO incident? He says, oh, sure. I mean, it's like he never forgot it. And so I said, do you have any firsthand knowledge of it? He says, oh, yeah, well, he says, what was interesting was that when this happened, it was like the base went into a lockdown, like an iron curtain had dropped over it. Nothing was getting in or getting out. The only things moving were airplanes that were flying in and flying out. Nothing on the ground. I said, well, how long did that last? He said, well, almost a week. And when the curtain was lifted, he said it was never the same between the base and the city of Roswell. The fellas were no doubt, well, we know for sure that they were told not to talk about the event. So the way they handled that is they just didn't talk. They'd come into town and didn't talk to the civilians. And the town itself became very distrustful of the of the base after that. And the base finally closed in 1967. So it lasted another 20 years, but it was never the same after that. There was an air of distrust between both parties. And Tom Brookshire was there at the time, and he was very aware of it because he knew some of the airmen there from the base. And the other thing he knew was that he got to see a piece of this strange memory metal. Some of his football friends ran into him at the gas station one day. He said, "Did you see that piece of metal that Roy Tyner has?" Now this is just after the whole thing had died down. He said, he's got this strange piece of metal over there. You want to see it. So, of course, Tom says, well, let's go over. Let's take a look at it. So they go over to Roy Tyner's welding shop. And, of course, Roy Tyner is welding away there. He's got the torch going. He's welding. And he says, what do you guys want? We want to see that piece of metal. We want to see that piece of metal you got. Nah, get out of here. He said, well, we're not leaving till you show us that piece of metal. So he puts his torch out, his acetylene torch, and goes over to his desk, pulls out from one of the drawers something that he wadded up in his hand, and he comes back over to the boys, and he holds his right arm out straight, and there's something in his clenched fist or something in his clenched fist. So he opens his fist, and out unfurls this silvery piece of metal about the size of the palm of your hand, just floating there in the air as it gently floats down to the floor. And the boys are dumbfounded because they figure whatever it was would go to, you know, drop to the floor, but it just sort of floated there. And they said, do that again. So Roy Tyner grabs it out of midair, and he wads it up again in his hand and opens it, and in the air it just floats again. And he finally says, you boys see enough? Now get out of here. So they wanted to know where he got it. Where did you get that? And he said, somebody who was at that flying saucer crash gave it to me. So he got it. Somebody had dropped in his shop and had given him the piece that he was keeping in a drawer. So now Brookshire, I mentioned all of the families that were haunted by this and had a negative experience. Brookshire himself, you've met people that are just sort of naturally affable. You know, they see humor in everything, and nothing seems to affect him. And he was one of those types of people. He always had a humorous quip, and it obviously, the 1947 event did not affect him in a negative way at all. And, he was an all-star football player and made the professionals. His number has been retired by the Eagles. Everybody in Philadelphia loved Tom Brookshire. I would say he is in the highest pantheon of, say, five athletes ever to play sports in Philadelphia. He is in that pantheon. He's held in that high esteem in Philadelphia. So, wow. But 1947, he was one of the children of Roswell.
Tom, we have about maybe 5 minutes left. Would you please share, you know what, you have other things that you're doing. Would you please share what's on your upcoming agenda with what you have on your plate?
Yes, we're trying to, as we speak, one of our Roswell books was optioned. The Children of Roswell is our fourth book about Roswell. An earlier book called Witness to Roswell is a script. It's been optioned by by Stellar Productions in Burbank, and for a couple of years now, the script has been written, and we're trying to get it sold as a major motion picture, but so far it hasn't happened, but we're still trying. We're also now trying, and this is brand new, to develop a five-part mini-series based on our latest book, The Children of Roswell, which, by the way, you can get at Barnes & Noble, or at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com on the internet. And now the internet, you could get it in regular hardbound book. You can get it in Kindle. You can get it on ebook. It's even out in audio books. So whatever your preference, you can get that on Amazon. And so that's pretty much right now what we're doing. We're still, of course, Don and I are still on the case. And this July, we'll be down in Roswell again during the – they have a UFO festival every July in recognition of the 1947 event. And Don and I have been speakers down there for at least 20 years, the last 20 years, and we'll be down there again this year. So that's what's going on at the moment. We're sort of in the – we're sort of – what do they call it when you're – sort of relaxing after since you know, for writing your, when you write your book and things get really hectic, we're sort of in now the relaxation mode now that the book is out. So that's where we're at right now.
Do you think you two will write another book together?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Next year is the 70th anniversary, so we absolutely plan on writing a book for next year. And it might be our last book on Roswell because everybody's pretty near gone now. But we're going to sort of summarize the whole thing with our conclusions. And, you know, we have over 600 witnesses, first and second hand. And so we pretty much have the case nailed. But we want to put something out with a title like The Roswell Verdict or The Verdict of History, something like that, for next year. So we have our website is www.roswellinvestigator.com. You can see our pictures there, and if you survive that, you can see you can order a book. And we are this is a quest that we've been on it now for a quarter of a century. It's the only case I've been investigating since 1991.
We really want to thank you for ongoing investigations and keeping our public apprised to new findings as well. This has been so great. You know, we could go on for another hour. This is.
I know. Thank you for sharing all your great stories. I mean, I know our listening audience will enjoy this interview.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Have.
It's been my distinct pleasure. And, sharing your stories is I've done a number of interviews, and it turns out that I never tell the same story in the same way. So you're probably used to that, but it's interesting. You could tell the same story, but it comes out every time it comes out different. I mean, you know, a little subtly, in a subtle way, but
yeah.
I hope you found them interesting, and to do something for 25 years, it has to be a labor of love, and certainly the Roswell incident has kept my interest for so long because it's a labor of love, which sounds odd, but I don't know how you could stick to doing something for so long if you didn't really like it.
Well, you know,
well,
life,
thank you.
Life brings. I was going to say, life brings us those intricacies that we could hardly believe ourselves as we deliver this information. And so, you know, we're all in this boat, and we're so happy that you're still moving around, giving it, delivering
well,
it.
We thank
well,
you
like
for sharing your labor of love.
Like they say, somebody had to do it, right?
Yeah. Right. Well, we need to go, and we thank you so much. Have a great day, Tom.
Well, you too, Taz and Paula, right?
Yes.
Right. You got it.
Yeah, I remembered your names.
Okay. Perfect.
Have a great day. Have a great day.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
A Napa guy knows the only way you'd give a freshly minted driver a brand new car is if he promises to never drive it. Instead, let him grind the gears and knock over the neighbor's mailbox in something a little more suited to his skill level. And with over 400,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, he can safely drive something that's nearly as old as he is. It's not perfect, but it's perfect for him. That's Napa know-how.